If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism.
Welcome back to Considering Catholicism. As always, I'm Greg, your host. I always am your host, and I'm always Greg.
Even on his free time.
Even on my free time, that is my nom de plume or my nom de guerre. Yeah, no, not really. I am Greg at all times. But I am not at all times with Corey.
True. Only a subset of your time.
That's right. We could do a little diagram.
For better and worse.
That's right. But this is one of those times that I am with Corey on the podcast. Corey, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
And Corey is suffering from some ailment today.
I've just got a cold, yeah. So I apologize for the congestion that you can hear in my voice. Recover.
I'm sure it's just a cold. I'm going to pray for Corey. I'm sure it's all going to be fine. So, but we are once again gathered today to talk about, I don't know, Catholicism and stuff.
Associated stuff,
because this is Considering Catholicism. So here's the thing that we were going to talk about today, and I'll break this up into two conversations, which means two episodes for all of you out there in listener land. But we had an email from a young man who, I won't get into all of the details of the email, but he was talking about how he enjoys listening to the podcast and how he's coming into the Catholic faith and getting more and more serious about it and relying on the podcast as one of his sources for information. But he talked about how he has some friends who are not Catholic, and in particular, he talked about one good friend of his who's not Catholic. And I showed this to Corey because we kind of had a chuckle about it, but he has a friend who's into, it's not going to sound funny when I say it, but who is into some like pagan belief systems.
Specifically Vikings, right?
Norse religion or Norse mythology.
Right.
Which is like the Vikings, right? Like Odin and Thor, and Odin had the raven and Thor had the hammer, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But he's into, I guess, Norse mythology. And so the listener was saying they were talking about Norse mythology versus Catholicism and the Vikings versus the Catholic Church. And then I guess somehow they got into this conversation, kind of teasing out from the listener's email, that the listener was saying Norse religion isn't good because the Norse religions, they were pagan and they did things like human sacrifices and stuff. And then I guess his friend said, no, they didn't. And then he said, yes, they did. And then he said, no, they didn't. And then he said, yes, they did. And I guess it became sort of like one of these, like
they had a hard time proving it one way or the other.
It's like the argument clinic on Monty Python. And it was like, and so he said, you know what, could we explore this on the podcast? And what do you say? And I came to Corey and I said, I don't know. I saw the TV series Vikings and Lagnar Rothbrok in Vikings, and they had some like stuff that looked pretty sketchy, like sacrificial stuffs. But I don't know. It was a TV show,
right?
So I have no idea. I have no knowledge of Viking human sacrifices, one way or the other.
Sure. And I mean, there are certainly instances of human sacrifices in pagan religions throughout time and space, but on the specific subject of the Vikings, I also don't have special knowledge.
Oh, and we'll get to that, because I'm sure before this conversation is over, we're going to talk about like the Aztecs ripping out the beating hearts of their enemies on the tops of pyramids. So that sort of thing did happen, but I thought it was an interesting opportunity to talk about not specifically Vikings or Norsemen or Viking human sacrifices, but more generally talk about how the Catholic Church has dealt with pagan religions.
Sure.
Over the last 2,000 years, and paganism in general, which would include the Vikings and the Aztecs and everything else. And so I thought this was really interesting because it has to do with the history of the Catholic Church, not only in terms of how it grew and its missionary activities and how it engaged the world, and the missionaries went to the four corners of the world. We talk about in the intro, the 24 time zones and two hemispheres thing, but also the Catholic Church's approach to non-Catholic religion or to non-Christian religions in general.
Yeah. And in all seriousness, this listener's friend is not alone. Like there are other people, there's a number of people nowadays who are interested in pagan religions for one reason or another. And so, it's something that's on people's minds. So,
Oh my gosh. If you go to, I was going to say Europe, but increasingly the United States, you're going to see just all kinds of people that are into whether it's Wicca or Druidism or this or that. I saw like some survey 10 years ago or something. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it was a joke or not, but apparently like on some survey or census documents in the UK, like 15% of the people checked Jedi as their religion.
I don't remember what the percentage was, but yeah, it's showed up in censuses.
Yeah. So, I mean, in all seriousness, as Corey says, people are increasingly in the West, I don't know, engaging with or fraternizing with or even becoming involved with various forms of paganism today. Mm. And we'll get later into this conversation about how you define paganism in the modern world. But I just thought we would talk about, over the last 2,000 years, how the Catholic Church has dealt with other religions and its great missionary efforts.
Yep.
So we kind of pre-gamed this conversation a little bit just because I thought this could get peripatetic. It's in my fancy word, yes, right? And of course, Corey knows what that means, but it means like wandering about aimlessly.
Well, I mean, you could talk about the entirety of human religious history if you wanted to, and that would be a long conversation.
We could get into a whole philosophy of religion and history of religion thing, and that's not what we want to do. I want to talk specifically about the missionary engagement of Catholicism or the Catholic Church over the last 2,000 years. And I thought to start the story, we actually have to go back more than 2,000 years to the Old Testament, to Israel, to the Jews, to the Old Covenant. Because that frames, I think, what happens in the New Testament, and the New Covenant with the apostles and the church. So if you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, right after the fall, and God pronounces the curses on Adam and Eve, he already begins to hint there that eventually he will redeem humanity that has fallen away from him. And throughout the Old Testament, there are these constant hints or clues or foreshadowings about how God will eventually work through the covenant made with Israel, and that through that covenant, he will redeem all of the nations and all of the religions, or reach all the nations and all the religions and redeem the world through that covenant.
Right. Yeah. You have that all over the prophets, but even right at the very beginning of the covenant with Abraham, where God gives him this vision of the stars in the sky or the sands on the seashore, through you all nations will be blessed and brought into covenant with me. I'm paraphrasing.
But. Oh, yeah. And then you see throughout only the narrative but prophetic sections of the Old Testament, these constant reminders of where the thing is going eventually. So you can go to the story of Exodus, Moses and the 10 plagues of Egypt, in which God shows his superiority over the false gods of Egypt. You can see when Elijah battles the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and the question is, who is really God? Is it Yahweh, the Lord, or the God of Israel, or is it the false god Baal? And so there's always this sort of running kind of contest where God is showing a superiority over the false gods of the nations. Mm-hmm. You can think of the passage in Isaiah where Isaiah mocks paganism. He says, a man cuts down a tree, and on half of it he cooks his dinner, on the other half he carves into an idol to worship after his dinner. And Isaiah is laughing at the foolishness of paganism. But then also Isaiah and the prophets hint about how eventually all the nations will come in. They talk about the nations of the world coming into the covenant.
Yeah, you have those passages in Isaiah where it's portrayed as like the people from all over the world coming to Jerusalem.
And that brings up an important point, because the old covenant was not missionary. Mm-hmm. All of those passages talk about how the nations will come to Israel. they will come to the covenant. And you have very few exceptions to that in the Old Testament. One obvious one is Jonah, who goes to Nineveh and preaches. But the whole point of that story is that the idea of going to Nineveh as a missionary is reprehensible to Jonah.
Right, he hates that idea.
He hates the idea because the Jews were not missionary. So they had the covenant, they had the truth, they had the worship of God, and they always rested on the promises that somehow, some way, the Lord would reach the nations and bring them to the covenant rather than them taking it to the ends of the earth.
And in all fairness to them, God had not yet explicitly given the missionary mandate. That comes with Christ.
Which brings us to the new covenant, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the old covenant in which all of those hints and clues and promises and foreshadowings are all there. But then we come to the division to the new covenant in Christ. So in Christ's death, resurrection, and ascension, we now have a new covenant in which now the missionary mandate is given, as you said. And the critical passage here is the very end of the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 28, verse 20, which Protestants know as the Great Commission. And I don't know, you and I joined the Catholic Church 8 years ago, and it's strange because when I mention the Great Commission, like, that's not a term that a lot of Catholics recognize.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just because we're encountering people who aren't as familiar with the gospel as maybe they ought to be, or if it's just not the terminology it's being used.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's just not the terminology.
It could be either.
But
yeah.
But also, it's the concept of the missionary Great Commission, at least in my experience since joining the Catholic Church, it's not a dominant concept that's preached a lot about, talked a lot about. But that's on an aside. I mean, certainly it has been over the last 2,000 years. And our point of this conversation is the Catholic Church has been missionary. I'm not sure whether American Catholics talk about it as much as they could or should.
Right.
But be that as it may. So Matthew 28:20, Jesus says, tells the apostles, is after the resurrection, before the ascension, he says, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go into all nations and make disciples, baptizing them and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded. And behold, I am with you unto the end of the age. Mm-hmm. That's known as the Great Commission. And what I want to do, just for the purpose of this conversation, is identify three movements or elements in that Great Commission. And the first I'm going to call proclamation. This is going out and proclaiming the gospel, proclaiming the good news. Go into all nations.
Preach.
Disciple. Yeah. Preach. Second is the establishment of the church sacramentally and communally. So go into all nations, make disciples, baptizing them. Mm-hmm. That is the establishment of the church. So the missionary, the apostles, from the apostles forward, goes, proclaims the gospel, then in response to that, then baptizes and establishes the church. And then there is that last part about teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded, which you can talk about discipleship, catechesis. But what I want to identify there is defending the church against internal and external error. Mm-hmm. Historically, there's both kinds. Once you have established the church, you know that error is always close at hand. Internal errors are going to be distortions of Christian doctrine that become heresies. So you want to teach everything that Jesus commanded so that the people don't fall away into heresy, as they did in the Old Testament. As you see examples, hints in the book of Acts where people, that's why Paul writes half of his letters correcting and rebuking churches that are falling away from true doctrine. And then the other side of that is not just the internal correction and discipling, but the external defense of the faith against the pagan religions and attacks of the pagan religions, which we typically call apologetics. Mm-hmm. That's that rational defense of the faith against its critics. So if you look at that pattern of proclamation, establishment of the church, and then defense against internal and external error, we can then take that template and look at how the Catholic Church has followed that for the last 2,000 years and how it's interacted with the pagan religions, whether it was the Greco-Romans or the Vikings or the Aztecs or whoever else, right?
Yeah.
So why don't you talk a little bit about that early patristic era? So from the time of the apostles, say, up until the Constantinian establishment of the church or whatever endorsement of the church, that period of the first couple hundred years, the first few centuries there from the first century up until about early fourth. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about how that template plays out in terms of the church's engagement of the classical Greco-Roman world?
Yeah, it happens very soon after Christ's ascension and sending of the Holy Spirit. The apostles start preaching right away. I mean, on the day of Pentecost, Peter is standing up and preaching to Jews and converts to Judaism that had come from all over the Greco-Roman world. They were there for the feast in Jerusalem. And as you said, he preaches, they respond, and immediately what the apostles are doing is baptizing them and teaching them more about Christ's commands and how they're supposed to live out this way that Christ has given them. So that happens from day one. And then very soon in the first couple of years, they more and more come to realize that this mandate is not just for those who have already been incorporated into the old covenant, but that the new covenant is supposed to be going out to the nations, as Christ said. So you have the incident in the Acts of the Apostles where the household of Cornelius, a Roman centurion, is preached to and baptized and brought into the church. And then this becomes the mission of apostles and evangelists, Paul being the most obvious example of that. So he's going throughout the Mediterranean, he's landing in a city, he's preaching to the Jews who already have a background in the covenant and accepting converts and also being rejected by some. And then he's going to the Gentiles. And you have a great example of how he's doing this later in Acts, where he's preaching in Athens, and he's sort of using examples or nitpicking from Greek wisdom and Greek religion to show both how Christianity is similar to or fulfills sort of desires that the pagans had, and also how it's distinct. He talks a lot about the resurrection of the dead, which is something that they don't quite understand or weren't expecting. And so you see that he's having to engage with pagans to preach the gospel and then baptizing and accepting people into the church. And then, as you mentioned earlier, then he has his work cut out for him, writing letters and making apostolic visits to sustain and defend the church from misunderstandings, from conflicts, and from sort of slipping back into the paganism that they had come out of.
Let's camp for just a second on what you described where Paul goes to Athens.
Yeah.
Because I think what he does there famously, he goes into the downtown marketplace, this area called Mars Hill, like a market area just below the Parthenon. Mm-hmm. And that's where you would have all of the philosophers and teachers and I suppose carnival barkers and merchants and everything
sure.
And Paul kind of goes into the center of that and begins to engage the pagans there. What's interesting about that incident in Paul is there's two dynamics going on. And the one is for him to, as you say, to kind of mine, I mean, M-I-N-E, like
right.
to extract,
dig up
the positive elements of paganism. Mm. Because not everything the pagans said was wrong. I mean, not everything that Plato or Aristotle right. said was wrong. At the time, you had the Stoics. Not everything the Stoics said was wrong. You certainly had like the Stoics with the classical virtues, prudence and temperance and fortitude and courage. Those were positive things. The early church fathers built on the works of Plato and Aristotle. Certainly later on, Thomas Aquinas would build on the works of Aristotle. And whether that was about philosophy or morals or cosmology, Euclid invented geometry. And just because he was a pagan, the geometry
worked. you don't reject truth that is there, both because it's truth and you reject it at your peril, but also because this is sort of an entry point for
this is what Paul unpacks in the first chapter of Romans, his letter to the mm-hmm. Romans. Because what he says is, it's been called a lot of different things, but there's a sort of a common grace. In other words, God has made certain kinds of truths manifest and knowable to the human mind. There are certain things you can know. You can know that 2 + 2 = 4. You can know the truths of geometry. You can know certain moral truths. Again, temperance, prudence, justice, and fortitude, right? Those are things that are knowable because God has, Paul says in Romans 1, God has made it knowable through the creation. Sometimes it's called the general revelation of God. And Paul is always sort of picking up on that and then talks about that at length. In fact, one of the reasons he indicts pagans or some pagan practices in Romans 1 is he says, you ought to know that some of the things right. that you do are wrong.
You should know better. Yeah,
because it's knowable that these things are wrong and bad, and you're accountable for them, okay? And then a special revelation, which is the specific knowledge that you can only have through the gospel. In that passage in Acts 17, where Paul is in Athens and he's engaging them, you see his sermon there is fascinating, because what he does is he mines or digs up or pays positive tribute to the truths that were knowable by the pagans and to the things that the pagans got right. But then he says, there are some things that you don't know. And this is the general special revelation thing, where he says, hey, as I was touring through your city, I saw statues to all of your various gods, right? Your Poseidon and Zeus and Athena or whatever. But I saw a statue to the unknown god, because the Greeks thought, what if we missed one? And he said, so you guys got some things right, but there's some things that you know that you don't know. And I want to talk to you about the things that you know that you don't know. And what I want to say is, I think there's a genius that the Catholic Church has always had, going back to Paul, where the Catholic Church has, in its missionary efforts, incorporated the best and positive qualities mm-hmm. of the cultures and systems that it met. And this is where Protestants sometimes want to get on Catholics, because they go, Catholicism over the centuries incorporated certain aspects of the Greco-Roman world, or as it went out into the frontier and it encountered northern European religion and incorporated certain aspects of those cultures into Catholicism or whatever. Protestants like to smack on Catholicism for that, but I look at it as part of the genius of its missionary efforts, mm-hmm. that it said, we can incorporate the truth and the virtues of civilizations that we encounter while purifying those and drawing them up and into the more complete truth that we have from Jesus Christ. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so Paul even says in so many words, like, in the ages past, God was content with the nations going their own ways. But now that the Christ has come, he is drawing all nations to himself. He is drawing them into the church. And so preaching the revelation of Christ and using the general revelation that they already have to bring them in and to get to that step of baptism and the establishment of the church. And so you have, within a generation or two, churches all over the Mediterranean world, and then outside of the empire, you have some apostles, Thomas famously, who went east and ended up in India. And so you're having scattered throughout this whole region, the known world at that time, Christian communities that are in communication with each other.
And so as the church grows and as it conquers the pagan world, mm-hmm. and it conquers pagan religion and pagan civilization, it throws out the worst parts of it, and it incorporates the best parts of it, the parts that are true. Mm-hmm. And there's another passage from Paul. It's from 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5,
yep.
that I think captures this. Paul says, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And I think this is the key to understanding, I think, the genius of the Catholic Church's missionary efforts, whether it was in the Roman Empire and encountering these other things, is to say, those things that are pretensions and stand up against Christ, we demolish those. But then when we recognize things that are valuable, we keep the value of those things. Here's an example that most people, I think most Catholics know this, right? So we, in Catholicism, the world is divided up into dioceses. Mm-hmm. So you have a bishop, and a bishop heads a diocese, and then within the diocese, there are parishes. So the diocese was actually a Roman government administrative district. It was roughly kind of akin to a county, which is about the size of what they kind of are, more or less. And it was a region usually around a city or maybe in a rural area. It was kind of like a county. So Roman taxation, there would be a magistrate over this diocese, and then that diocese would be divided up into parishes. Mm-hmm. Just like we have counties and townships, the Roman Empire was divided up into dioceses, these administrative regions. They have like provinces and dioceses and then parishes. And you would have magistrates and government officials and taxation. As the Catholic Church spread throughout the Roman Empire, it sort of made sense that you would have a bishop in each diocese. Mm-hmm. because he is the bishop, usually in the city, whatever the center of the urban area or the central market town or whatever in that diocese, the bishop would set himself up there, and then he would send priests out to the various parishes and townships. And so then as the Roman Empire ebbed and faded away, what's left of the Roman Empire to some degree is this structure of dioceses and parishes. So there is kind of an example of where the Catholic Church sort of took elements of it and incorporated in, which Protestants hate because they're always like, well, look, see, you've incorporated paganism. No, what we did, according to what Paul says here in 2 Corinthians 10, was we demolished those pretensions and things that stood against Christ, and we took captive those things that were positive.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, there are two interesting things that come to mind when you talk about dioceses. One is that the guy who restructured the empire like that was Emperor Diocletian, who was one of the biggest persecutors of the church. Right. So that just goes to show that even someone who wanted to stamp out Christianity, there was something neutral, something good that could be used, that could be taken from him and from his governing strategy of the empire. But two, you pointed out that the churches tended to first be planted in cities. It makes sense, practically speaking. That's where there's a center of population. And so when Paul is traveling the empire and preaching, it's Thessalonica or Corinth, where the churches tend to first take root. And then in the early period, Christianity is predominantly, but not exclusively, that urban phenomenon, urban religion. And that's actually where you get the word pagan to begin with, because pagani, that Latin word, is for basically the country folk, the people who weren't in the cities and who a lot of them were still practicing the old religion when Christianity started to become more dominant in the empire.
I had an older Catholic priest tell me a few years ago, he said, we're the Roman Catholic Church. And the one thing that the Roman Empire was obsessed with was record keeping. And as the Roman Empire faded away, the one thing we kept was the obsession with record keeping, because the Catholic Church is meticulous in its record keeping, sacramental records and everything else.
Sure, sure.
But then you can look at other aspects where culturally, as the church encountered not only the Greco-Roman culture, but also some of the other pagan cultures, where there were certain cultural things you borrowed. So, for example, this whole silly Protestant argument that Christmas is somehow a pagan holiday that got incorporated, and I don't even want to deal with that right now.
We've dealt with that before. Anyways.
We've dealt with it before, but it is true that one of the things that the pagans did often was to bring green things into their home in the winter. And since the Nativity of Christ, which was not tied to a pagan celebration, it was tied to astronomically when Christ was born and this and this and this. So I'm going to get into all that. But the point is that it coincided with the winter. And one of the things that people did in the Roman world was when it was cold and wintry out was you brought green things in. And so this is where you have this whole silly sort of mythology about the Christmas tree that gets it sort of exactly backwards. The notion that the Catholic Church brought Christmas trees into the houses and then invented Christmas to justify the trees rather than to say, hey, we're having the feast and the nativity. And by the way, it'd be nice if we brought some green things into the house because that's things that, you know, something that we're used to doing culturally. And as you go along, whether it was that, whether the church going into Northern Europe, whether the church coming into the Americas, whether the church going into Africa or the East, the Catholic Church has always, again, taken captive everything for Christ, demolished the pretensions and the bad things, but incorporated what was positive into this universal Catholic Church.
I think that's a good transition. Then let's move off of the Roman Empire, properly speaking, into the early Middle Ages, when the empire was fading away, when you had different peoples from the East, the Goths and the Vandals and all of these people coming into the lands that had formerly been the Roman Empire. And you have the church sending missionaries, so famous names like St. Patrick, but many other saints that don't have the same kind of name recognition now, but who would physically, like St. Paul, go into pagan territory and preach the gospel. And just as many Christians had been martyred in the Roman Empire before the church was established, many of them were martyred as well. But at the same time, many pagans of these new people groups accepted the gospel. And so you have the establishment of the church over hundreds of years in what we would now call Europe.
Now, since the listener, the original listener that we were talking about in this episode, talked about the Vikings Northern religion, I want to give two examples from Catholic missionary history about the ways that the Catholic missionaries in the Middle Ages contended with paganism. The first, since we're talking about the Vikings, the closest one that I can think of off the top of my head is St. Boniface. Mm-hmm. So St. Boniface is somewhere up in the north countries. I don't know whether it's Denmark or northern Germany somewhere, right? And he's encountering these Northmen or whatever. And I don't want to get into too many details here because we're running kind of on time, but you know the story probably better than I do. But apparently there was this area and there was some sacred tree that they were all worshiping. Right. And so it was driving St. Boniface crazy because he was trying to preach the gospel to them. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's cool. That's cool. And then they go up at night and, like, I don't know, adorn and dance around the sacred tree and get drunk and do whatever things they did around the sacred tree. And so it was driving St. Boniface nuts because it's like, you come here and I'm trying to explain the gospel to you. And then you got this stupid tree and you're going up and worshiping the tree. So love this dude. Absolutely love this dude. He decides to sort of like make simple work of this.
I'm just done with this.
So he takes an axe and he chops down their sacred tree. And they're like, what have you done? You've chopped down our sacred tree. The sacred tree is a false god and you have to stop dancing around the sacred tree. So I've solved the problem.
I proved it.
Yeah. Because they're like, if you chop down the sacred tree, then Odin or Thor or somebody will zap you with a lightning bolt. And he's like, well, I chopped it down. I'm standing here. It's got like Elijah on Mount Carmel.
Daring,
like, where's the lightning bolt? And so I just love that because it was an example of how those Catholic missionaries sort of boldly went out and contended with the pagan cultures. And in ways like Elijah did on Mount Carmel against the prophets of Baal, or Moses and the 10 plagues on Egypt, where let me challenge your false gods. Another one was St. Patrick in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So there was this one night of the year where no one was allowed to light a fire during that pagan night, this Druidic holiday. The only person who could light a fire that night was the High King under the Druids. So everybody else had to sit in the dark all night. And it turned out that it coincided with Easter, the Paschal celebration. And so St. Patrick goes up onto this high hill and lights the Easter bonfire. Mm-hmm. Could be seen for miles and miles around. And he was daring them. You know, I'm celebrating the Paschal fire. I'm celebrating Easter here and the resurrection of Christ. And so he lights this giant bonfire seen for miles around. All of the Celtic warriors and stuff go charging up there. But as they approach the hill, he's standing there going, hey, I'm here and I'm proclaiming the resurrection of Christ. What are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And in his boldness, they like, oh, wow. And I just love these stories about whether it's Boniface or Patrick. And you could so many stories of Catholic missionary saints over the ages that went into these pagan places and challenged paganism, which leads to one that I just want to bring up because the guy's not a saint, right? But you and I were talking about this earlier. So one of the things that you get into is what about when the Catholics came to the New World?
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And today we would say, well, you have to be inclusive of the cultures you encounter, right? You can't say that somebody else's religion is wrong. You have to respect their religion. So when Cortez and the Spanish conquistadors came to Mexico and they fought the Aztecs and they went to what is now Mexico City. Now, I'm not saying Cortez was a missionary saint by any means. But one of the things they encountered was, okay, here's this great civilization of the Aztecs, and they have this big city on the lake and the whole nine yards, but they also have this pyramid, and they take the prisoners that they capture in war from the other Indian tribes, and they go up there on the top of the pyramid, and they cut open their chest and rip their beating hearts out and hold it up to the sun god. And not only just Cortez, but the Spanish missionaries, the Franciscans and Jesuits he was with, said, much like St. Boniface said, no mas, right? Like,
this has to go.
No, right? Like, and so again, the boldness, because today we'd say, who are we to say you shouldn't like rip people's hearts out on a top of a pyramid? The Catholic Church said no. And in fact, in just one little sidebar on that, when we talk about Catholic missionary history, it was the Catholic Church that first began to talk about human rights for the Native American. It was, who was it, Corey?
Bartolome Las Casas.
Yeah. Who was a, was he a Dominican or a Franciscan?
Oh, I always forget which order he was in. But he was one of those.
Yeah. One of the orders. And what happened was he was observing how the Spanish conquistadors, which were the civil authorities, were treating the Native Americans. And he writes the Pope and says, hey, wait a minute. These are human beings and they have human dignity and therefore created in the image of God and they have human rights. And so the Catholic Church is always, and I say this contra, on the one hand, the secularists who say the Catholic Church steamrolled over and destroyed all of these cultures, and contra the Protestants who say the Catholic Church went out and incorporated paganism. I think the Catholic Church and its missionary efforts in countering pagan religions, whether it was the Greco-Roman world, whether it was the Vikings, whether it was the Celts, whether it was the Aztecs, whether it was the Jesuits went to China and India and Japan, what the church always did best was going in and doing what Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 10, which is overcoming the pretensions and the false claims of the pagan religions and defeating those pagan gods, but then incorporating whatever truth and best aspects of those cultures there were into the universal Catholic Church. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as I think has been implicit in what you've been saying is that for the first 15 centuries approximately, probably longer, the 16, 17, 18 centuries of the church, you had sort of the base, what has often been called Christendom, the countries or nations that were predominantly Christian and from which missionaries went out to the rest of the world. And so you had that start around the Mediterranean and what was the Roman Empire, spread up into the northern parts of Europe. And then when the Age of Discovery began and Europeans were able to go further down into Africa and out into Asia and discover that there was a whole couple of continents that they hadn't been aware of before, the missionaries were always going out from those Christian lands to these places that haven't been evangelized. But we'll see when we have our second conversation, yeah, that things changed.
Yeah,
quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it's a great segue here because we're going to just hit the pause on the recorder and record a second conversation because, I, like you say, we hit a certain point where Christendom, the notion of Christian civilization that was, in a sense, sending these missionaries out under the aegis of the Catholic Church, gets shattered. And for the last 300, 400, 500 years, we've had a very different situation in terms of what missions looks like and how we engage the religions around us. So we're going to take a pause and record that. If you've been listening and you enjoy this, thank you for listening. Go to the website, consideringcatholicism.com. You can see all the episodes there categorized by content. You can also leave a message. You can write a review and you can support the podcast, which we really appreciate. This is a ministry with a one-time or recurring donation. Also, please, as I always say, do me a solid here. Rate the podcast on Spotify or Apple or Amazon, wherever you get it. That really, really helps us, as is writing a review on Apple Podcasts or on our website. Those things really, really help us to grow the podcast in terms of visibility. So appreciate that. And we'll be back here in the next episode to talk about the Catholic Church's missionary efforts as Christendom, crumbled. Yeah.